101, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Brian Lynn, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
An environmental group says a program to save one of Kenya's most famous animals has returned a group of mountain bongos to the wild. The International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, said disease, illegal hunting, and forest loss have left fewer than 100 wild mountain bongos. But last week, conservationists released 5 of the large creatures into the 3.1 square kilometer Moingu Mountain Bongo Sanctuary near Mount Kenya. The mountain bongo is one of Kenya's most important iconic animals, said Najib Balala. He is the country's Minister of Tourism and Wildlife. He spoke after cutting the ribbon at the sanctuary's opening ceremony on Wednesday. The bongo's release is the high point of a breeding and rewilding program that began in 2004. Rewilding is a term that means planning the introduction of a rare animal back into the wild. The goal is to have 50 to 70 bongos in the sanctuary by 2025 and 750 by 2050, the government says. This is like the first step in the recovery, said Isaac Lekolul, head of veterinary services at the Kenya Wildlife Service. Mountain bongos once moved in large numbers, but the few remaining animals live in forested areas around Kenya. Their bodies have thin white stripes, making them easy to recognize. The IUCN said local people are hunting the animals, including with dogs. Robert Arujo is head of veterinary services at the Mount Kenya Wildlife Conservancy, or MKWC. He said, "This species is being driven to extinction in the wild unless something is done quickly." Extinction is a term that means the complete disappearance of a species. Arujo added that MKWC has set up community conservation, education, and empowerment programs to bring attention to and help reduce the human threats to the animal. MKWC has also involved local communities in planting over 35,000 local tree species around Mount Kenya to help the damaged forest. To help maintain genetic health in the breeding program, approval has been given to import bongos from Europe and America, Arujo said. I'm John Russell.
A new study provides additional evidence that COVID-19 can damage parts of the brain. The study said that even people with mild sickness can suffer brain tissue shrinkage and damage to areas that control smell. The research was led by scientists at Britain's Oxford University. The researchers said their study provides strong evidence of brain-related abnormalities in COVID-19. The team noted that past studies have also found links between COVID-19 and changes to the brain. But those studies centered mainly on COVID-19 patients who were hospitalized with severe sickness. The latest study recently appeared in the publication Nature. The team said further study is needed to find out whether the brain changes are long-lasting and can be fixed. The study involved 785 subjects in Britain between the ages of 51 and 81. All were given two brain scans to measure differences during the experiment. A total of 401 subjects were found to be infected with COVID-19 between the scans. Most of them had only minor sickness. The researchers reported a number of brain effects in the patients. The subjects experienced the effects, on average, 4.5 months after infection. The changes included a greater reduction in gray matter thickness after individuals were infected with COVID-19. Gray matter in the brain helps people control movement, memory, and emotions. The greatest reduction was seen in areas of the brain linked to smell. In addition, some infected patients also showed a reduction in whole brain size, the researchers reported. On average, subjects infected with COVID-19 also showed greater cognitive decline linked to an area of the brain related to cognition. Gwenaya Duo is a professor at Oxford and the lead writer of the study. She said in a statement that losses in gray matter and the tissue damage in infected individuals led to a reduction in their abilities to perform complex tasks. All these negative effects were more marked at older ages, Duo noted. A key question for future brain imaging studies is to see if this brain tissue damage resolves over the longer term, she added. The study was carried out when the alpha version of COVID-19 was widespread in Britain. Past studies have found that some COVID-19 patients suffered from brain fog or a lack of mental clarity. The condition can cause memory problems and reduce a person's ability to be attentive, concentrate, and process information normally. The researchers did not say whether vaccination against COVID-19 had any influence on the brain changes. But the UK Health Security Agency released findings on the issue last month. The agency said an examination of 15 studies found that vaccinated people were about half as likely to suffer long-term effects of COVID-19 compared with unvaccinated people. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. For many blind people and those with vision difficulties, Life can be made easier with a guide dog. But making a good guide dog takes much work. And for many, the long road begins when the dog is a puppy. Take, for example, the 5 8-week-old puppies that arrived at the Tipton Airport in Fort Meade, Maryland, early in February. At that time, they were loving, playful animals, like all puppies. Now, however, the Labrador Retriever and German Shepherd puppies are on the road to becoming useful members of society. If they prove themselves able, they could become guide dogs. They will help to improve the lives of people with vision loss and vision impairment. The faithful friends-to-be are part of a training program of an organization called Guiding Eyes for the Blind. The puppies flew from the organization's head office in Yorktown Heights, New York, to Maryland, on board a Pilots to the Rescue flight. Pilots to the Rescue is a not-for-profit organization that transports animals as well as people at risk, it states on its website. The puppies were born in Yorktown Heights, and they spent the first 2 months of their lives with their moms and siblings. The young dogs were bred for health and temperament. Here, temperament means how they respond to their environment. However, breeding alone will not be enough to turn these puppies into guide dogs. They will need training from dog training experts. They also will need to be nurtured by volunteers called puppy raisers. The goal of this nurturing by puppy raisers and their families is to turn the energetic, playful puppies into well-behaved and well-socialized dogs. These are the qualities needed for a successful guide dog: well-bred, well-trained, well-behaved, and well-socialized. The process will take about 14 to 16 months of weekly classes and testing. Training starts with the basics: name recognition, behavior, and commands, such as sit and down. The trainers then move on to more complex commands. After that, the puppies are given to the puppy raisers. The raisers and their families will show the puppies the world and how to act in it. A manager for Guiding Eyes for the Blind's puppy program is Cindy Tate. She told the Associated Press that other experts will keep a watchful eye on the training and help with any problems the raisers may have along the way. Once a solid, loving foundation is in place, puppies must leave their raisers and return to the Guiding Eyes Training Center for official guide dog training. Formal training is where the dogs demonstrate whether they will become a guide dog for the blind, a different kind of service dog, or someone's pet. This means there is almost always a tearful goodbye. Denali is one of four bigger puppies. He was placed aboard a return flight to Guiding Eyes the day the new puppies arrived. Tate got tears in her eyes as she watched puppy raiser Carolyn Schaefer say goodbye to the yellow Labrador and walk him to the plane. "This is the hard part," Tate said. But she said a guide dog has the power to help people, and that softens the blow, an expression that means makes a hard thing easier. even though it can be very hard to leave the puppies. Puppy raisers come back over and over. Tate herself has raised many. She lists them all. Roxanne, Katrina, Valor, Gus, Mystic, Organ, Kelby, Tad, Eagle, Winnie, and now Kenji, her 11th future guide dog puppy. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. American military planners had to make an important decision when the United States entered the Second World War at the end of 1941. American forces could not fight effectively in Asia and Europe at the same time. The military planners decided to use most of their forces to defeat the German troops of Adolf Hitler. Only after victory over the Nazis was clear in Europe would they use all of America's strength to fight Japan in Asia and the Pacific. Because of this decision, Japan was able to win many of the early battles of the war in Asia. The fighting in the Pacific is the subject of our program this week. Japanese planes bombed the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii on December 7, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
We take you now to Washington.
The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The surprise raid marked the first of several major victories for the Japanese. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, Imperial forces attacked American bases in the Philippines. And within days, Japan captured the American island of Guam. Japanese troops landed in Thailand. They marched into Malaya, and they seized Hong Kong. The Japanese also moved into Indonesia and Burma. Even Hitler's troops in Europe had not moved so quickly or successfully. As one American historian wrote later, the Pacific Ocean looked like a Japanese lake. The United States began to fight back. General Jimmy Doolittle led a group of 16 American B-25 bombers that took off from the aircraft carrier Hornet and bombed Tokyo in a surprise raid.
The B-25 was selected because it was small, because it had the sufficient range to carry 2,000-pound bombs, 2,000 miles, and because it took off and handled very well.
It was a bold move. The B-25 had never been launched from an aircraft carrier before, and the demands on the planes and the pilots were even greater with the weight of a full load of bombs. Japan's leaders believed no army could stop them. So they expanded their goals and launched new campaigns. That was Japan's mistake. It stretched its forces too thin and too quickly. The military leaders in Tokyo believed that the United States could not resist, because American forces were busy fighting the war in Europe. But no country could extend its communications and fighting ability over such a great distance and continue to win. The turning point came in June 1942 in the Central Pacific with the Great Battle of Midway Island. Japanese Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto launched the battle. He wanted to meet and destroy the remaining ships in the American fleet before the United States could recover from the destruction at Pearl Harbor. Yamamoto had 162 ships. The American Admiral, Chester Nimitz, had just 76. But the United States had discovered how to read the secret messages of the Japanese forces. For this reason, Nimitz and the Americans knew exactly where the Japanese ships would sail, and they put their own ships in the best positions to stop them. The fighting between the two sides was fierce, but when it ended, the Americans had won a great victory. Admiral Yamamoto was forced to call off his attack and sail home. For the first time, the Japanese Navy had been defeated. The next big battle was at Guadalcanal, one of the Solomon Islands in the southwestern Pacific. Guadalcanal's beaches were wide and flat. Japanese officers decided to build a military air base there. The United States learned of the plans. American commanders decided that they had to prevent Japan from establishing that base. United States Marines quickly landed on the island. They were joined by troops from Australia and New Zealand. But Japanese ships launched a surprise attack and destroyed many of the American ships in the harbor. Allied forces on the island were left without naval support and suffered heavy losses. For 6 months, the two sides fought for control of the island. Historian and naval officer Samuel Elliott Morrison described the fighting this way in his book, The Struggle for Guadalcanal.
For us who were there, or whose friends were there, Guadalcanal is not a name but an emotion, recalling desperate fights in the air, various night naval battles, frantic work at supply or construction, savage fighting in the sodden jungle, nights broken by screaming bombs and deafening explosions of naval shells.
The fighting continued seemingly forever, but finally, in February 1943, the Japanese were forced to leave Guadalcanal. The battle was an important defeat for Japan. It opened the door for the American and other Allied forces to go on the attack after months of defensive fighting. But American military planners did not agree about the best way to launch such an attack. Admiral Nimitz of the Navy wanted to capture the small groups of Japanese-held islands in the Pacific, then seize Taiwan, and finally attack Japan itself. But General Douglas MacArthur of the Army thought it would be best to attack through New Guinea and the Philippines. The American leadership finally decided to launch both attacks at once. Nimitz and MacArthur both succeeded. Nimitz and his naval forces moved quickly through the Marianas and other islands. General MacArthur's troops attacked through New Guinea and into the Philippines. American ships defeated Japanese naval forces in the battle for Leyte Gulf. Throughout the Pacific and East Asia, the fighting continued. Many of the fiercest battles were fought on tiny Pacific islands. Japanese troops captured the islands early in the war, and they quickly built strong defenses to prevent the Allies from invading. Allied military leaders found a way to defeat the Japanese plan. They simply avoided the islands where the Japanese were strong and attacked other islands. But sometimes the Allies could not avoid a battle. They had to land on some islands to seize airfields for American planes. The names of these islands became well known. Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands, Truk in the Marshall Islands, Saipan in the Marianas, and other islands including Guam and Tinian. The two sides fought fiercely in the Battle of Iwo Jima. And on Okinawa, Japanese forces resisted for 83 days before finally being defeated by Allied troops. After the defeat at Okinawa, many Japanese understood that the war was lost, even if Japan had not yet surrendered. Emperor Hirohito appointed a new prime minister and ordered him to explore the possibilities of peace. But both sides still expected the Allies to launch a final invasion into Japan itself, and everyone knew that the cost in human life would be great for both sides. But the invasion never came. For years, American scientists had been developing a secret weapon, the atomic bomb. The code name was the Manhattan Project. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use it against Japan.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
American planes dropped one of the bombs on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And another on Nagasaki 3 days later. Exactly how many people in those two cities died from the force and heat of the blasts, or later from radiation, may never be known. The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. Japan surrendered on August 15, 1945, 6 days after the Nagasaki bombing. Suddenly, sooner than expected, World War II was over. More than 50 million civilians and soldiers died during the 6 years of fighting. Germany and Japan were defeated. The Soviet Union was strong in much of Eastern Europe, but the United States found itself the strongest military, economic, and political power in the world.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.